This is July 11th, 1984. Rose Dornant is recording her experiences with the Women's Army Corps. Rose lives at 323 North Walnut, apartment 501, Lansing, Michigan, 48933. Her telephone number, the area code is 517. The number is 372-1715. If there are any questions concerning this interview, Rose can be located by telephone or by letter at the number or the address. Rose, what did you do prior to enlistment?
I was a legal secretary in the Attorney General's office in Lansing, Michigan, in the collection division. And when I went into service, when we landed in California, the WAC officer came running out, "Is our legal secretary present?" I kept my mouth shut because I wanted something different. I had visions of patching the boys up overseas. So the other girl was one, there was a little Jewish girl there that spoke right up, oh, she would be interested in that. But guess who got the assignment? Rose Dornant got the assignment. So I was a legal secretary right from the very beginning.
Rose, what date was this?
I went into service in February of 1943.
1943.
Right, and then after Army basic training at Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, which was a month or 6 weeks, I don't remember now, I believe 4 weeks. From there I went to Army Ad School in Russellville, Arkansas. And from there I was assigned to Lemoore Army Airfield in California.
Where were these schools? Were they in established colleges or?
Yes, the Army Ad School was at the Russellville State College. Mm-hmm. It was really a lovely place. And from there I went, got my first assignment at Lemoore Army Airfield, and I was assigned as with courts and boards, legal secretary, and I was reporting, not general courts, the special courts.
Who taught these courses?
Who taught?
Regular college professors or the Army?
There was no course in this.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a legal secretary, so they just assumed that I could do it, which I did.
I see.
The funny part of it was the officer, the head of the judge advocate's office, asked me how fast I could type. I believe I told him 75 words a minute. And he said, "Well, we'll see how fast you can type." And he didn't know beans about, you know, how fast a stenographer could type. But
how did he judge it?
It beats me. Anyway, they were satisfied. There was a GI doing this job at the time, and he wanted to get into the fight. Of course, this was the purpose of the WAC, to relieve men at the desk for, you know, combat. This was our purpose, and when they saw us coming overseas, they didn't like it, not the armchair commandos. But Harry Samiak was his name, a nice guy. And one time we had a terrible case on the base, a rape case, and they had pretrial hearings. And Harry took part, and I took part. And after when we were transcribing our notes, when Harry was stuck on something, I could transcribe his notes and vice versa. So we were quite a bit of help to each other. We fortunately learned the same type of shorthand, because not everybody writes the same type, you know. But let's get to overseas. This is what this is about, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, then from California, I was sent overseas.
Where?
We landed at Firth of Clyde in Scotland.
In Scotland? Mm-hmm. What year was this now? 1944.
In 19... March of 44.
March, a whole year before the war.
Yes, I was
ended.
A year in California.
Mm-hmm.
And
now you're in Scotland.
Right. And here's something. Guess what was waiting for us on the other side? A Scottish band with the skirts and all playing their bagpipes. And they... took us right to the train, and then we went through Scotland by train, and all the way down we got the V sign from the Scotch people. It was really quite a nice ride. And we went to Taunton England was our first.
Taunton?
Taunton, England was my first assignment.
T-O-N-T-O-N.
T-A-U-N-T-O-N, right.
T-A-U-N.
T-O-N. And this was a lovely manor out in the country where we worked. And they had fireplaces in each room, you know. And they don't have central heating in England. If you've ever been there, you'll know that. And it's really cold there in England.
I avoided going there in the winter for that reason.
And so, and there was a lovely pathway, you know, going up to the castle. We used to call it the castle.
But it was cold.
Well, yes, it depends. I forget the time of year that we went. Well, it was in March or April. Mm-hmm. And
by that time,
of course, we had gone to the staging area first in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And boy, when they played the Star Spangled Banner at the parade that we were in there, boy, there wasn't a dry eye on that field. Because, boy, you really get patriotic when you're away from home.
That's for sure. That flag means a
oh,
lot.
Oh, boy,
too.
I'm telling you. Well, anyway, after that, we went to Taunton. And again, I was assigned to courts and boards. But there were no court hearings there. But this Major Timothy...
Rose, before you go on, though, what were your living conditions like? Did you have a bedroom of your own?
Are you kidding? We lived in Nissen huts.
Oh, you lived in huts?
We lived in Nissen huts.
Nissen? What's a Nissen hut?
Well, it's a round hut, you know, the metal, the gray metal round hut.
Well, you didn't live in this castle.
Oh, no, we worked there.
You worked there. Fine.
We worked there. Mm-hmm. That was just down the, up the road a piece.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So, no, we lived in Nissen huts. And there were, oh golly, there must have been about 20 in a hut. There were rows of beds on both sides. And uh-huh. They had these potbelly stoves in the middle, one or two. And no, that was...
No bathrooms?
Oh, we had bathrooms separate from there.
Outside?
Yeah.
Temporary?
Well, I don't remember whether they were temporary.
Okay. They could have stayed there for a long period of time, all right.
Now, wait a minute. I think they were, they weren't, you know...
They hadn't been established before you came?
I think they had been, yes.
Oh, they had been.
And,
okay.
And sort of square buildings. Mm-hmm. And
did you have hot water in there?
I don't remember. Oh. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. That was an inconvenience many people put up with.
I know. We had a lot of cold water. I do recall mm-hmm. that. But they had these Lister bags, you know, hanging outside that you were supposed to drink water out of because the water was supposed to be contaminated. Mm-hmm. Well, I never drank out of that water. I drank the contaminated water all the time I was in England. And there were terrible stories going around, you know, about finding dead rats in the wells and stuff. But that Lister bag water was just like rotten eggs. It was terrible.
We had to use it in Tokyo, too, for 2 years.
It was
after.
Terrible, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
Anyhow.
It wasn't that bad. Not in Tokyo.
It wasn't?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
no.
They're probably...
Purified it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the major dictated letters on how a soldier should act in the service. I mean, these were the kind of letters that I got in Taunton. And then, while I was in Taunton, my youngest brother was on his way overseas. I knew this. I knew that he was on his way overseas before I got back to my base. And see, I had gone to L.A. to visit with Vic because I knew he was going overseas. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to Lemoore, my friend had signed me up for overseas, and I got over there before Vic did. And so when I heard from him that, you know, he was landing at such a place, so I wrote and told him how to get in touch with me, to call the Red Cross, you know. And dressing to go into town, which was a couple miles away, my friend is on CQ, and she comes running, "Rose, Rose, Vic is on the phone." So I go running down the cobble path in my stocking feet. And she acted just like she knew him, you know, from way back. And mm-hmm. So it was something. So Vic, we weren't in Taunton very long, just a couple months. Then we were transferred to Salisbury.
Oh, you mean you were in the same area with your brother for
a
couple months?
No. No, he was in the Midlands.
Oh, I see.
And he had come down to visit me after we had moved to Salisbury. I notified him where I could be reached, and he and a friend of his, who was on the same crew with him, Coder, his name was, came visiting, and they went out to the base, which is a couple miles away from town. And my friend and I had gone into town for the first time and having a great time looking over this British hamlet, you know. This was Salisbury, England. It was a lovely place. And we ended up at the Red Cross. This is a great big place.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went in, on the main floor was this big dance going on where the GIs were dancing with the British gals. And we didn't bother going in there. And we went downstairs, and there was this great big room with tables. And then at one end, they had Coke machines. We spotted that Coke machine. We made a beeline for it because we had never seen, we hadn't had seen Coca-Cola since we left the States.
Mm-hmm.
And Vic and Coder were sitting at a table down there. They had been out to the base, and of course I wasn't there, so they went back to the Red Cross. And they had talked to the Red Cross girl, and they saw us coming in. And so he sent his friend up to the counter to give us the 012. They had tea and crumpets up there, you know. And so this fellow comes up, and he has the 8th Air Corps patch, and same as my brother. Oh, what outfit are you in, you know? And he tells me the next number to Vic's, and he gives me the 012 about being from Lansing, Michigan. And then while I was picking out some crumpets, he advises up my friend that Vic is there, so she was wise to it. So this is this great big room, and we're walking across it with carrying these crumpets that we had picked out. And Vic, of course, had stooped down so I wouldn't see him. And as I approached, he straightened out, and I just let out a scream when I saw him. And the Red Cross gal upstairs wondered what the fight was about. Then she realized it must have been me meeting my brother. My friend Zeke, I dubbed her in the service, will never forget that.
Mm-hmm.
She just, when we get together, why, we go over all these things. But I'm telling you, this is my baby brother, and it was really something. I got together with him.
It means a lot overseas.
Oh, it sure does. He was flying with the 8th Air Corps. He was the engineer of the crew.
Rose, you're from a large family. How many of your brothers?
There were three of my brothers in the service.
In
I
the
have
service?
Five brothers, yes.
Wow, and three
four of
the
us
service?
Were in, and the law of averages was against us, but we all came back. The Lord was good to us.
Oh, wonderful. Now, were they, what other areas?
They were in the Air Corps, all three of them. My brother Tony was never got overseas. He was stationed in the States. He was a flying instructor. And he almost got sent to the same base where I was in the Moor.
Uh-huh.
But just missed it. Anyway, he never got overseas. And at the time the war ended, he was in fighter training. He was so itching to get into the fight. But I just thank the Lord that he never got in.
Uh-huh.
Because the law of averages was really against us. Anyway, Sam was with the Air Transport Command. And he was stationed in Cairo, Egypt. And Vic, the youngest boy that I met in England, was flying with the 8th Air Corps, and they were bombing missions over Germany. And I really sweated that kid out. But I could go to the phone and call him, you know. And when I first heard that he was there, I didn't have the nerve to go to the phone and call him. And the major kept telling me, why don't you go to the phone and call him? Why don't you go and call him? So my friend Zeke goes to the phone and calls him.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah. Anyway,
could you do this at all times or just at certain periods of time?
No, I could do it at any time.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know whether Vic could on the other end. But he was stationed in the Midlands, and he came.
Where are the Midlands?
This is in Shakespeare country. That's in the middle of
oh,
England.
Oh, I see.
I never got to Stratford on Avon, but Vic did. But I went up to see him at. I forget the name of the place now. Anyway, while I was visiting him at his base, I stayed with a Red Cross girl there. She had an extra room. And the funny part was in October, they were having a Halloween party. And the next morning, the boys were scheduled for a deep penetration, a DP, they called it, into Germany on a mission. And as I lay in bed, I heard the planes revving up and revving up. It never took off. Pretty soon, the Red Cross girl knocks on the door, your brother's out here. They had scrubbed the mission, so Vic and Coder were outside.
Right, scrubbing, you mean canceled.
They had canceled the mission,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Right, but
and
the term is scrubbing.
Yes, it? And then Vic said that they were scheduled for a slow timing job. This is a skeleton crew going up with a plane to break in a new motor on the plane. So I went up with them on this, and it was really quite an experience. We flew all over England. You could see right straight down, and England has a beautiful countryside, neatly tailored, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Vic gives me a flying suit to put on, And I put on this flying suit, and of course it had a slit from here to here, you know. Mm-hmm. But I had GI underwear on, so it didn't make any difference. But the one of the young officers was shocked to see me in that. But I wouldn't have wanted to be in anything else, climbing up on that truck to go out to the plane, and then climbing up on that plane. It was quite a climb.
And back in those days, women wore dresses at yeah. all times, didn't they?
Yeah. Anyhow, Vic would show me all the spots on the plane. And he tried to get me to sit in the turret, the belly turret. Uh-huh. I says, nothing doing. This is the bubble that hangs below the plane. Uh-huh. So we had Johnny Heatley from Detroit, who was the turret gunner, get into it. And he's curled up with that gun, and then Vic closes the door on him and locks him in. That poor kid is in that, just hanging down from the plane, you know. If something happened, it'd just be too bad. So then we go to the tail gunner seat, and I said, go ahead, sit in. And the seat is going up and down like this, and they call the tail gunner Jeters. So you can understand why they called him Jeters. He's a nervous wreck. That tail spot was just bumbling up and down all the time. Well, then when we came down, Vic had me go on one side, and he went on the other side, and he showed me what to do to lower the wheel on that side while he lowered it on the other side. It was quite an experience. Then, too, I had gotten into the nose of the plane, too. I just don't remember the... And we forgot to turn in access selling. The boys used to hear access a lot, and we forgot to turn her in. I would have liked to have heard that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was quite an experience. So then, I had planned to get together with Vic for Christmas. And I had been transferred.
This is 44.
This is 44. But in November of 44, I was sent over to France. But D-Day is, I missed D-Day. D-Day in Salisbury, England. You know, recently when they had all these things on TV about D-Day and about
yes.
the paratroopers, we saw those gliders going by in droves loaded with paratroopers, and we knew where they were heading. We had met some of the boys in town.
Well, this is in June, isn't it?
Yes,
45?
This is June of 44.
44?
Right.
Okay.
D-Day's 44.
Oh, yes.
And
you were in France?
No, I was in England. I was in Salisbury, England. See, some of our girls were sent down to the...
Let me get these dates straight. D-Day was 44.
Absolutely, June
6, 1944. And you were in...
Salisbury, England.
On D-Day?
Right.
I see. Okay, yeah. But when did you go to France?
In November.
November, oh, that's after D-Day.
Right.
Okay.
You see, the wax didn't get set up over there
mm-hmm.
until... Well, in the meantime, while we were stationed there, one of the girls that was stationed with us in California was secretary to the general
mm-hmm.
in Europe, and she stopped to see us gals. She arranged for the general to request us by TWX for certain jobs. So this is how I got to Paris. I flew over. And my friend Zeke, she went over on a boat and really roughed it on Omaha Beach in tents like the boys did. And another friend from New York went down to Plymouth.
Were your restrictions changed drastically after D-Day?
Well, not in England.
Not in England.
No, because I did get to London with my brother Vic when he came to see me. We went back to London together, and we had our picture taken together in a studio in London.
But you were sort of free?
Oh, yes.
Didn't you have hours to keep in the wax?
In England?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that there was a bed check
there
time.
There were restrictions.
I think there
were...
was a bed check time.
Mm-hmm.
But there were, we lived out in the countryside, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had to go into town if you want to do anything.
I see.
But when
the
I
restrictions...
There weren't really any restrictions in England
uh-huh.
to speak of. There was bed check time.
Weren't confining to you.
No, no.
Mm-hmm.
There was bed check time, of
right.
course.
Mm-hmm.
But in France, there were no restrictions either. We were in a fancy hotel in France,
oh,
Le Renault.
But let's go back to England now. How did D-Day affect the people? You're in England at D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
How? What was your reaction when D-Day came?
Well,
And the people of England's reaction?
Well, I don't know, because we weren't that close to them. We were out in the country, you see.
Out in the country.
And we never really got close to anybody in England. Well, the closest I ever got to anybody in England was at a pub,
I see.
You know. And there were ladies serving behind the bar in these pubs.
Mm-hmm.
We had never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now we have that in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, and I met this RAF boy there, little guy. And he was cute, but you know, there were GIs in that place, and they were giving them the old one, too. So what did this little meek boy do? He grabs me and he kisses me soundly in front of these GIs.
But then D-Day was nothing...
No, it was nothing spectacular in England, because the troops were going over from England.
Mm-hmm.
Down on at Plymouth and on the shorelines where they were crossing, the channel, that was where all the action was. Now, one of my friends was down there at Plymouth, and she said that all the boys had their heads shaven, you know, before going across, because they never knew when they'd get a haircut again. But anyway, this Vinny, this Italian boy that was with the paratroopers, when they came back from the D-Day mission, we met the boys in town, and they cried on our shoulders, telling them terrible things they had seen. Apparently he was not a paratrooper, must have been a mechanic, because he came back. And they saw some of their boys get their heads chopped off by their own propellers, something like this. So when they came back, they gave all of them a bottle of whiskey, you know, to forget their woes. Well, these boys just cried on our shoulders at these things that they had seen.
I can understand.
He was just a kid, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whatever happened to that boy. I mean, we just saw them twice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, this friend had the general request me by TWX for the judge advocate in Paris. And when I got over there, our plane landed at Le Bourget, or Lindbergh landed. And we on the way from Le Bourget to Paris, we saw German tanks, you know, on the roadside that had been... put out. So quite a bit of destruction. But then when we get into Paris, I forget now just where we were, where they had landed us. But anyway, this one girl that was stationed in California with me spotted me and took me under her wing, and she took me to the adjutant general's office. And I said, told her I was supposed to be going to the judge advocate's office. But this man didn't pay any attention to us. Is it still running?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Didn't pay any attention. He signed me to statistics, would you believe? I was in statistics exactly 3 days. Well, in the meantime, my friend was working for the general, and I had gone up to see her and had met the general. The general wasn't in, but he came in while I was there, and I met him. And, of course, this is getting ahead of my story. I'll go back that when I first, these statistics, we were a bunch of young men. I can't think now. The head of the department was a good-looking man with red hair, beautiful red hair. And he called me in for an interview the minute I got there. And he was asking me, I had never smoked a cigarette up to this point. He offered me a cigarette and I took it. And so I'd watch him, and every time he'd take a puff, I'd take a puff. Anyhow, the girls nearly bit my head off when I went over with only one carton of cigarettes, because I could have brought two over.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't think about it. You know, I wasn't smoking then.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't start till one of my roommates just kept bugging me, oh, come on, Rose, have one. Come on, Rose, have one.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally started, but I could take it or leave it, you know, then. Anyhow, this I forget this man's name, who was the head of statistics. But he was comparing their operation with DuPont and, oh, you know, putting on a big falderal for me. And then he said, I was in there a good long time. He said to me, when you hear two buzzes, that means you're to come in here for dictation. So I get back to my desk and buzz, buzz. I says, was that two buzzes? And he said, yeah. Oh, I got to go take dictation. I grabbed my book and I went in. And his desk was cluttered so that I couldn't put my book on his desk, so I put the book on my knee. And he was reading a form letter and going like a bat out of hell. I said, well, you old so-and-so, I'll show you, you know. Well, I was very careful with that And I was very careful that I didn't make a mistake, because it had to be perfect. And I come to the end of the page, and of course overseas, you turn the page over and you wrote on the back to preserve, to conserve paper. So I said to myself, now shall I use another page or shall I do it on the back? Well, I better do it on the back. So I did. And I'm not nearly through, and he comes to the door and looks at me. And I'm perfectly calm, cool, and collected, and I says, I'll be through with this in a minute. And so he goes back, and I'm through, and I take it back. I made sure that it was perfect. So he couldn't find anything wrong with it. So he comes back and tells me that I should have used another page for the second page instead of doing it on the back. Well, anyway, I was there exactly 3 days. This young Lieutenant Hill, who I was secretary to, was really a nice guy. And I had gone down to the general's office to visit with Trudy. And I said to the general, after I met him, I said, do you mind if I go home? I've got nothing to do. He said, no, if you've got nothing to do, you go home. So I went back and I tell these young lads that the general said I could go home. You can imagine. So I went home, and the general had a staff meeting. And he says to the judge advocate, how do you like your new secretary? He says, new secretary? I haven't got a new secretary. Well, then the fur started to fly. But the next day, I was in the judge advocate's office. Oh, I'm telling you. So, but I reported courts martial in Paris, the special courts. The general courts were, I sat in on a general court once in California.
What's the difference between a special court and a general court?
There is a big difference. In a special court, you don't have to get it verbatim. When you transcribe your notes, you put down that such and such was said. So you don't have to put it verbatim. But you write verbatim as much as possible, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
But in a general court, you have a board of officers. Well, you do in a special court, too. You have a board of officers. It's the Colonel Maple. Oh, he was such a nice guy. And then there were other officers in the, I forget, and I think there were about five on the special court. But in the general court, there is a court officer, I forget what they called him. He was more or less a law officer, you know. And at one hearing in California, I sat in with Harry Samiak. And at one point, I just put my pen down, and he spoke to me, keep writing. So I started writing again. But you know, it was people talking, you know, a lot. You didn't know who was saying what. Anyhow,
is still in Paris.
No, that was in, I just went back to California for that one general court that I sat in, but I never took a general court in Paris.
Uh-huh.
It was always the special courts, and the summary courts didn't require a hearing. I used to type up the orders for them, and,
What were some of the nature of these?
Well, the summary courts were mostly AWOLs.
Oh.
AWOLs. Now, on the special...
Away without leave.
Yes, absence without leave.
Uh-huh.
And the special courts, I had two cases to really stand out that were quite funny. One case was one of the girls in our office, there were just two girls. I was one, and then Peg Tocher, who was a Scottish girl. And she was an American citizen. Her folks had come on to this country years before, and she, of course, was interested in going to Scotland. So she was on the boat crossing the channel to Scotland, and here's this GI impersonating a colonel on the boat, and Peg had to be a witness in this trial. It was really funny. When the major read the court hearing, he sat in his room and he, ha ha ha, Peggy, come in here. Oh, I'm telling you, this fake colonel approached to Peggy, and I don't remember now what went on, but it was really funny because Peggy was a real quiet girl, you know. And mm-hmm. That was one case. And the other case was against a member of the U.S. Army band, who was drunk on duty and fell off his chair during a performance. Well, this fellow used to bug me. We used to go into the Red Cross, you know, a lot, and he'd always be there, and he'd bug us about we didn't do anything in the service, and what were we doing, and stuff like this, see. And so he's on trial, and I'm taking the hearing. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine them. I guess he knew what I did in the service then. Anyway, he had a general come in and testify for him, and it happened, the story goes, that he had a headache, and he went into a French bar and told the guy that he had a headache, and the guy gave him some anisette for his headache. This is a whiskey. And he got cracked on the anisette. Mm-hmm. So he falls off his chair in the performance. So
I remember what was any punishment meted out to him?
He was acquitted.
Oh,
he was acquitted because of his years of service. He was in the Army 15 years, and he had a good record. And of course, the general came in to testify for him. He was acquitted, but just the same, I got a bang out of that because this guy used to just turn me off, you know. He used to just bug me at the Red Cross, mm-hmm, about the wax not being any good and stuff.
Now you're still in
Paris.
Paris.
Yes, and during the
after the war.
No, this is during the war.
Oh, you're.
This is during
D-Day.
The war. Oh no, this is after D-Day. We went
after
over to
D-Day.
Paris.
All right, but
that's when we.
It's after the war in Europe.
No, ma'am. This is when we got into the war in Europe.
Okay.
We were, the war was going on when I got there.
I see.
But Paris didn't get any bombing or anything, although we had blackouts, which were brownouts in Paris. I mean, you could really see. But during the Battle of the Bulge, it was a very scary period.
Rose, I guess I'm a little confused with D-Day and VE Day.
Well, D-Day was June 4th, 1944, in England, and that was when the boys crossed the channel for the invasion of France.
Okay.
Now, we haven't come to VE Day yet.
Okay.
During the Battle of the Bulge, as I was saying before, it was a scary period, and there was a curfew on in Paris, a 9 o'clock curfew, and everybody had to be off the streets because there was a report that Germans were walking around in our uniforms. Well, they caught up with a few. In fact, I saw one in the headquarters, in our headquarters one day. And he was just a kid, looked just like one of our boys, one of our American boys. And they had caught up with him.
Harry, what did they do to that German boy who was walking around in an American uniform?
I really don't know, but I imagine he was taken prisoner.
I see, prisoner of war then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
he wasn't harmful, was he?
He didn't look harmful at all. No.
I see. No. just trying to get away from it all. You can't blame
he
him.
He was probably glad to be caught up with, you know, the poor kid. Anyhow, there were a few occasions that were quite memorable in Paris. Bastille Day was one. You know, they had parades, and it was really something, a dancing in the streets at night. It was quite...
It was in July of 44.
Yeah, July 14th of 44,
mm-hmm,
on Bastille Day. It was a gala day in Paris. We went to the Place de la Bastille. That's all it is now, just a place, you know, a big center with a square, a big square with a monument in it. There's no prison there anymore, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, gosh, we walked back from there, went back to our area, and it must have been miles and miles. And I don't think I ever went back to the Bastille after that. I remember that night we danced in the streets.
Is this outside of Paris?
No, this is in Paris.
Right in the heart of Paris?
Well, I was near the heart of Paris, but mm-hmm, the Bastille was a ways out.
Mm-hmm.
But, see, I was near the Arc de Triomphe.
Mm-hmm.
My hotel was this gorgeous hotel. It had a glass elevator with a wrought iron, and it was just beautiful. Anyhow, we were on the first floor, which is the second floor there. And we had the suite on the corner. Really.
Private bath and all?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
oh
wonderful.
Yes.
You were living it up in Paris.
Oh, we were, I'm telling you.
And no sign of war there?
Not really. No.
Not really?
Uh-uh.
This is 44.
Mm-hmm. No, this is now in early 45.
See? Oh, early 45.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In 44, when I went to London with Vic, there was some buzz bombs going over. We had to make a beeline for the...
Shelters.
Shelters.
Mm-hmm.
But the British, you know, they just walk along like it was an everyday occurrence. And when I got off the train, when I went to London one other time, we were transferred there for a few days. And we got off the train and we heard boom. And I asked this Limey, we called him, what was that? He says, V2. That was the second, what did they call those, missiles that the Germans were sending over. You didn't hear them approach. You did the V1s. But the V2s, you didn't hear them until they landed. And it landed quite close to the railroad station because we heard it.
Did they do a great deal of damage when they hit?
Well, they do ordinarily. Of course, I didn't see where they hit.
Mm-hmm.
We were at the station. We're getting back to Paris and Bastille Day. I remember we were dancing in the streets. And we went to the Eiffel Tower had a WAC GI club on the second, on the first landing. And it was quite a, you could look all over Paris and that from there. It was open, of course. And they served champagne, and I think it sold for about $20 a bottle. But the GIs forked over $20 for it. And they had dancing up there. It was really something.
Rose, what was your rank in the Army? You were
I was a WAC. And I ended up as a T sergeant, as a technician fourth class.
Technician fourth class.
It's equivalent to a buck sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
According to the TO, the table of organization, I should have been a master sergeant. But I never pushed for promotion, you know. I don't care. And at one time, they were giving direct commissions, and the major called me in and wanted to know if I was interested, and I said, no, I'd rather not.
Do you happen to remember your wages overseas?
Oh, it was very minimal. I think it was only around $40 a month.
But this was all clear, all expenses were taken care of except your...
And I used to send it home.
Pleasure.
I think I just kept maybe $5.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent it home, and my sister banked it for me.
Okay.
No, our
back in those
salary
days,
was very minimal.
$40 a week would have been normal salary in the States.
In those days?
Yes. I remember in
1943. Well, I think I was getting $155 a month in the AG's office when I left to go overseas.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you had no living expenses, so everything was clear.
Mm-hmm.
You're clothing furnished, or did you pay for that?
Oh, no. Officers had to buy their own clothes, but not enlisted personnel.
And you don't remember much about Christmas of 44 over there then at all?
No, it's just that they had a special dinner for us.
I see, but it was...
I've got the menu someplace.
More of
yet.
The same? They had a Christmas tree up somewhere?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall now.
I see.
But they must have had.
No, nothing special?
No, just a special...
Dinner?
Dinner. I think we had turkey and the trimming.
You ate well?
Yes, and overseas, if you didn't eat everything on your plate, it was a court-martial offense. And sometimes your eyes were bigger than your stomach, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to eat, to clear everything on my plate. To this day, I clear everything on my plate. I only take a little bit. Because people were starving all around us.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one day I saw a well-dressed old lady rummaging through a garbage right on the Champs-Élysées.
Mm-hmm.
It was pathetic. And boy, the way they drive over there, they got honk, honk, honk all the way up the street to tell you they're coming, you know.
Were there quite a few cars in France?
Oh, not really.
In Paris?
I'm thinking of after the war, because I went over after the war.
But during the war, there weren't many, were there?
No, and those that were propelled by gas, and I saw one peddling a car.
Did they have charcoal burners over
yeah,
there?
Yeah.
Well, they did, like they did in Japan,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I understand that some of the... the French people buried their cars so they would be safe after the war.
Oh, really? I never
oh,
heard
yes.
that. No, I never heard that.
I hadn't heard it either until someone up in my hometown bought a very expensive car.
Well, I don't blame them, do you?
Buried it and tried to claim insurance on it. And his brother-in-law squealed on
oh,
him.
Oh, my goodness.
And then
Later I heard that they did this in Europe in order to safeguard
the
borders.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised.
Until after
no.
the war. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's really funny, isn't it? Oh, gosh. I've lost my train of thought.
Well, now you're in 1944.
45. We're in 45.
45 now.
45.
All right.
And now let's get to, one time they had a big parade in Paris. It must have been on Bastille Day.
That would have been in July. Of
44. Yeah, July 14th. Mm-hmm. I can't remember whether that was the occasion or not. But you know the Parisians, they all rushed down from the wee hours of the morning to the Champs-Élysées to get their places, carrying chairs and ladders and whatnot to get their places to see the parade. And
mm-hmm.
really, the parades are something to see there. They have African troops marching and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so when VE Day comes, this is really the occasion. 3-day celebration, I'm telling you. On this other, the other parade, we couldn't get across the Champs-Élysées. We had to take a metro, an underground, to get across to the office.
Yeah.
And only just a few blocks away, which we ordinarily would walk, see.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, our hotel was
streets
right
were
the
so crowded, you couldn't get across, is that it?
On a parade day, yes.
On a parade day.
Yeah. So on VE Day, there was really celebration in Paris. 3 days of it, 3 solid days. And gosh, I think we had gone to the Place de la Bastille and had climbed on the back of cars and were just creeping along, you know, the Champs-Élysées when we got there. And of course the French were very agreeable to having us climb on their cars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really something. And there was dancing in the streets. And I'll never forget this one Russian soldier coming down and standing up in a Jeep, just like he had won the war all by himself. I'll never forget that sight. He was coming down the Champs-Élysées. Anyway, that was really a time of celebration. And we had gone to see some of the boys that were in hospitals that had been prisoners, and they had come, you know, we were dancing in the streets with them too. Then I was there on BJ Day, and that wasn't a big celebration day for anybody around Paris like VE Day was, but of course the GIs and the WACs were. And we had this favorite place, La Croisière, and they used to serve La Croisière cocktails. And these boys that we had met had been stationed in Germany, and they were on their way to England to visit some people that they had met there, but they never got to England. They spent it in France with us all week. We had a great time with the boys. But and they had come back to Paris on VJ Day, and I get a telephone call from this friend and telling me that he's at La Croisière, and he says, come on down. I said, nothing doing. So he comes up and to get me. He walks right into my room, you know. I said, Mommy, what are you doing, you know? So then we walk back to, this is near the, when I went back to France in 1961, do you think I could find that place? I thought it was near the opera, and it was, I guess, around the corner and down the street a ways. I found out later from a friend of mine who was with me there. But then comes, this is August, the VJ days in August 14th, and I can't remember anything spectacular happening after that. Oh yes, I went to Reims on Pass and to meet this friend who was stationed at Camp Philip Morris. The camps were named after cigarettes. And it was about 30 miles away. So I went out there by bus. And they drove me back to Reims, it was Reims, to Reims in a Jeep, 30 miles, in the open air, you know. I got to Paris and I had lost my voice from riding in that Jeep. I ended up in the American hospital there, only because I had had a cramp in my side the night before, and they thought it was appendicitis. That's why I landed in the hospital. But they had put me over, they had this great big, what do you call this stuff that steams? You know, to steam your...
A vaporizer?
Vaporizer, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Great big thing. That they put a towel over your head, and then you were to breathe that in deeply
mm-hmm.
for 20 minutes at a time, 3 times a day. Well, do you know, the next day I got my voice back.
That
it was
would
really
be good.
Funny,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, then comes time, the point system comes out, and everybody's anxious to get home. We didn't expect to get home for another year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point system comes out, and So we're anxious to get home. I had 40-some points, 43, I guess. I don't remember what we had had. Anyhow, my brother Sam was in Egypt, and I hadn't seen him yet. I had gotten together with my brother Tony in Muskogee, Oklahoma, when I was in the States, and with Vic in L.A. and also in England. But Sam, so Sam was planning to come to Paris, and I knew this. And here we had our orders to go home. You know that we both left Paris the same day. He came the last week I was in Paris. And we both left Paris the same day. He went back to Cairo and I came home.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a great time that weekend. We were walking down near the, what is that place? We were walking on the Rue de la Paix, where they had this Red Cross place, where we usually ended up. Mm-hmm. We're walking down the street, and here's a kid who lived down the corners from us in Lansing. He says, "Your name wouldn't happen to be Stornet, would it?" It's a small world. It's a small world.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came with us. And so they took me home. And then the boys went out that night. They went to the Club Lido, which I had heard about. And I had never been there. And of course, they had the girls walking around in G-strings waiting on table. And they'd sit on the boys' laps and things like this. We'd heard about it. And the boys didn't want me to go.
But you had to.
Well, I had never been there, but I had been to the Club Chantilly.
Oh, yes.
Where they had all these gals walking around in G-strings. But they had a beautiful act in this. They had this one girl that was dressed up in this old-fashioned outfit with a big picture hat, and she was swinging from the ceiling. And it was just beautiful. And we had gone up there with two of the boys who had come in from the front lines, you know. And they look so pathetic when they first come in. We meet them at the Red Cross, and they go in, they shower and clean up. And so we go out with them. And we took them to the Club Chantilly. And we were sitting in the balcony, and those poor boys were embarrassed to death. They'd look, and they'd see these naked girls. They'd look back, and we didn't pay any attention, see, but they were embarrassed to tears. But then when Sam came to Paris, I took the boys there. And, Bob was dancing with me. Some lieutenant, Second Louis, goes up to my brother Sam, who was a master sergeant, and he says, "What do you mean, bringing an American girl in here?" Sam says, "That American girl happens to be my sister, and I'll take her any damn place I please." He didn't tell me this till after we came home. which I thought was pretty cute. Anyway, Sam was flying with the flying supplies.
And what month is this?
This is in November of 45, just before
November
I came home. I left.
Just before. Well, weren't you in Nuremberg?
Oh, no. I had never gotten to Germany.
Oh, for some reason or other, I thought you were at the war
no.
Trials. And, oh.
No, I wanted to get over there. One of my roommates was stationed in Germany.
Then how long were you overseas altogether?
About 19 months.
19
I was in
months.
Paris a whole year.
Mm-hmm. Were you homesick during any of that length of time?
Never
homesick.
Never.
There was always enough action in the Army.
Well, and the girls were like family.
Yes.
And they still are. I've gotten together with them.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, for a while there, I was going to New York every year, and four of us would get together, and we'd pick right up where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning to go again this fall. I got to contact one of the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it was really, I mean, it's an experience that is the most vivid part of my life.
I would
have done it right over, all over again.
Yes, I think I would too. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I traveled at the time.
Yeah.
I had the energy to mm-hmm. see everything and do
then
everything.
I had the opportunity to go down.
Learn.
I had the opportunity to go on the Riviera too and pass after VE Day.
Mm-hmm.
So we were down there.
Oh,
for
but then you did leave from Paris to come back to the United States. Now, what did you do when you came home, Rose?
Well, I couldn't stand Lansing. So one of my roommates in Paris lived in St. Louis, Missouri, and she came up to visit with me. And I went back as far as Chicago with her. And I went to see another WAC friend that I was stationed with in Oglethorpe, who was a dear friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed with her for a week, and I went to look for a job in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't go looking for a job till the last day of the week. So I go to the Zinser Personnel Agency, and the personnel gal is on vacation, so one of the attorneys, but they had sent me to this attorney's office, Gottlieb and Schwartz. And so this young attorney interviewed me, and he says to me, "Well, do you think you can handle the work?" I said, "Sure." She says, "Well, come to work tomorrow." I said, "I can't. I got to go home and get my clothes." So So they let me come home, and I went back a week later, and I worked in Chicago for 3 months. But about that time, I was getting feeling kind of guilty, because here I am, the girl, and I take off. My mother's not feeling well, and the three boys are home, and I'm the girl, and I take off. So I decided I better come
home. You always had a very close Italian family anyway.
Oh, right. Yes. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Before we went overseas, we were all home together at one time. And that was really something. I was going to go, before going to overseas, I was going to go visit my brother Tony in Oklahoma instead of coming home. But I get a wire from Tony that he's on his way home. So then I go home. And I knew that Vic was on his way home because he's scheduled to go overseas. Then Sam was stationed at Romulus, so he got home practically every weekend. So we were all home together, and it was really a great day. My mother never forgot it. She'd always, you see, when she was expecting Vic, and Tony gets home first, she thinks it's Vic. And so they hug him all up, and my father says, "That's not Vic, it's Tony." So then they had got to hug him all over again. The boys looked that much alike. I mean, they're about the same size. I can't see that they really resembled each other that much. But in those days, in their young days, you know, they looked quite similar. And it was really funny. And so the next day, Vic arrives, and he comes in, and he whistles to my mother, he says, "Hi." She thinks it's Tony walking.
Why did you dislike Lansing? Was it because there wasn't enough action here, or you couldn't find anyone to communicate with who knew the things you knew?
Well, I don't know what it was, but I just couldn't stand it.
You were restless.
Yes, and so I just, when I got to Chicago, I looked for another job. But I was only there 3 months. I was bucking that State Street traffic every day, just eating, sleeping, and working, and that was it. So I decided to come back home.
I think when I came back, I found that no one understood the things I said, or they thought I was putting on airs, or something of the sort. So consequently, I was sitting back and listening and picking up the repertoire that they had.
Well, I was nursing a broken heart at the time, too.
I see.
It took me a long time to get over that. It took me about 6 months to get over that. But it was really funny. You know, Michigan is one of the few states that gave us 6 months to come back to our old jobs.
Oh, yes.
And most states only gave you 3 months. Mm-hmm. So it was 5 months. So I wrote there our personnel man that I wanted to come back to work, so I just came back to my old job.
Mm-hmm. You were happy then?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had gotten over money, so that was it.
May I ask you how old you were when you went overseas, roughly?
Well, I was 27 when I went into service.
And
I was 30 when I came out. Mm-hmm. So I was 28 when I went over.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful years of one's life.
Oh, yeah.
I was about the same age when I went to Tokyo.
Really? Mm-hmm. Really, I think when you're older, it's better.
I think so, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were mature enough to gather information to really blend it into our personalities and into our, you know, intellectual background and so forth, and stable enough to see that we kept out of
that's it,
difficulty.
I mean, that was it. They always warned us about. It was really funny, you know, the girls, the French girls, would always approach the guys, and, you know, about sleeping with them. How was it they said? Oh, vous voulez coucher avec moi? That was it, I guess. You want to sleep with me? And and of course, we didn't. Well, one time we were out in the country. I guess we'd gone to this hospital to see the boys. We were walking back in the dark, and there was French fellas following us and shouting at us, you know. And we hopped a ride on a half track, you know, one of these great big things like a tank. These boys came along and gave us a ride. It was really funny. We get into Paris, and they let us off on a corner. And you should have seen the French all rush around to that half track. But it was really something.
I felt that there was a feeling of security overseas. For example, I never had anything stolen. I felt as long as I conducted myself properly, I was treated in the same way.
Of course, you weren't...
I wasn't
you
over there
confined
during the war.
At all.
That's right. We were not confined in any way, shape, or form. But, I mean...
You went over after the war?
Yes, I went over in 49.
Oh, that's
Japan.
A long time after.
Mm-hmm, right, 4 years. Mm-hmm. But there was still quite a bit of rubble in Japan.
We used
a Lister bag then.
Oh,
and we lived in a hotel. Our living was quite different probably than it was during wartime. We had no fears. And the Japanese were extremely subservient to us.
Well, that would have been after the war. Mm-hmm.
But it was the interesting part was meeting so many people from all over the world and
listening to all different viewpoints, seeing all different places in the world, recognizing how other people live. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I remember one time on the elevator in Paris, I don't remember where I was, but these Frenchmen were saying among themselves, were wondering what I was, what army I belonged to, so I said to them, "Je suis Américain," and they were very pleased that I spoke to them in their own language.
Did you learn much French?
Well, I was really getting into it. Madame Gan lived next door to us in the hotel, and she was an American citizen. She had gone over to France during World War I. She was 18. She married a Frenchman over there and stayed there. So she came over and offered her services to the Americans. So she had a French class, and she thought that I would be the one that would really, you know, go on learning it. But I was giving it the Italian twist for a long time, you know.
Did you speak Italian at one time, Rose?
Oh, yeah, I can speak it elementary, you know. Siciliano.
You probably like to poke Italiano.
Oh, un po' così. But when I went over to Italy, you know, these Italian boys said, "You don't speak Italian, you speak Sicilian."
Sicilian. You speak what?
Sicilian.
Oh.
Sicilian.
Oh, Sicilian.
It's a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a difference in every province.
Oh, yes, I understand.
In Rome, I couldn't understand a word in Rome. Every province has its own dialect, just like the South here.
From Italian to French would be quite easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, but I was going to let the Italian twist a lot.
All right, you're back home. Is there any anything else you'd like to tell us?
Back home? Not really. I did go back to, I visited with my niece down in southern Illinois, and Major Avery, who I worked with in Paris, is near there, so I wrote him and told him that I was going down there, and I'd like to visit with him if it was all right with them. Oh, he was thrilled to death. He said his wife wanted me, was anxious to meet me and stuff, and that they would meet me at the airport and all this. So when I got down to Nina's, my niece, the flight arrangement had been changed, and I was getting into St. Louis as a later time, so I called the major to tell him, and he calls back in a little while, and he says, "Well, instead of you going all the way to, I forget that, you have to ride an hour to catch a plane down there, and yeah, I forget now where it is in Illinois. Anyway, Lincoln's hometown, what is it?
Springfield.
Springfield,
Illinois.
Yeah, Springfield. Mm-hmm. Instead of going all the way to Springfield and then going, coming all the way out here from St. Louis." He says, "Why don't you meet us halfway at such a place?" And I said, "Just a minute, Major. I'll let you talk to somebody who knows what you're talking about." So I put my niece on. She says, "Oh, yes, I know where that is." And she said I never told her that he was in Troy, Missouri, because it was quite close. So they drove me down there, and the Major and his wife picked me up down there. It was fun.
You still have contacts then?
Oh, yes. We still correspond, I mean, at Christmas time. And when I went overseas in 61, I wrote the Major, and he was thrilled to death. He wrote me a nice long letter, because he and his wife were planning to go over. He wanted to know different things. Did I see this? Did I see that? And stuff. But, no, I still hear from him at Christmas.
Oh, wonderful. Well, is that all then, Rose?
I think so. I think that's enough, don't you?
All right. That's fine.